Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the new novel Hotel Iris by the Japanese writer Yoko Ogawa. Maureen says that in Ogawa's recent books, like The Diving Pool and The Housekeeper and the Professor, Ogawa has proven herself to be a literary connoisseur of off-kilter relationships. In her new short novel, she offers yet another variation of this unsettling theme.
Hotel Iris, Yoko Ogawa's tale of sadomasochistic love, is mercifully short. I say mercifully because this is a novel you find yourself reluctantly transfixed by. Ogawa is a writer capable of seducing readers against their will. And as proof of her power, she's racked up major literary awards in Japan and serious critical raves in this country for many of her 20-some previous books. Like her compatriots, Kenzaburo Oe and Natsuo Kirino, Ogawa is drawn to the grotesque in human personality and behavior. In Hotel Iris, a 1996 novel newly translated by Steven Snyder, that fascination with the grotesque is explicitly, even repellently, sexual. This isn't the kind of redemptive novel suited for one of those brisk publisher appendices entitled Questions for Book Group Discussion. Instead, think decadent, minimalist, profoundly sad, and warped. Ogawa's novel is set in a moldy seaside hotel, presumably on the coast of Japan, but given the sparse detail here, it might as well be Torquay or the Jersey Shore. Mari, our main character, is a 17-year-old high school dropout and the daughter of the proprietor, a widow who barks orders and cuts corners. When a newly arrived guest turns out to be blind, Mari's mother abruptly downgrades her room to the one with the worst ventilation and no view. Unconsciously revealing her mother's ruthless frugality of emotion, Mari recalls that when her grandfather became ill with cancer, he suffered for almost 6 months, but he died in his own bed. We had given him one of the good mattresses from a guest room, but only after it had broken a spring. Whenever he turned over in bed, it sounded like someone stepping on a frog. One evening in the off-season, something crashes in one of the few occupied rooms, and a disheveled woman, obviously a prostitute, runs out and down the stairs screaming curses. Her middle-aged customer also steps out of the room. He's impeccably neat, and when he coldly orders the prostitute to shut up, Mari is mesmerized by his voice. As she later says, "I was confused and afraid, and yet somewhere deep inside, I was praying that voice would someday give me an order, too." Mari's dark wish is granted. When she spots the man again in town, she follows him, and they strike up a conversation. She learns that the unnamed stranger works as a Russian translator and lives in an isolated house on an island off the coast. Soon Mari is taking the ferry out there for trysts, whose brutality is made all the more shocking by Mari's poetic, enthralled descriptions. Here's a restrained snippet. "He had undressed me with great skill, his movements no less elegant for all their violence. Indeed, the more he shamed me, the more refined he became, like a perfumer plucking the petals from a rose, a jeweler prying open an oyster for its pearl." Mari subjects herself to all manner of humiliation without a trace of self-understanding, and that emotional ignorance is precisely what draws readers in and compels us into subjecting ourselves to the harsh pleasures of this novel. We can connect the dots between Mari's mother's stinginess of spirit and the allure of the translator's cruelty, but Mari can't. She's too young and too tamped down. What also imbues Hotel Iris with an undeniable magnetism is Ogawa's mastery of mood. This is such an offbeat, out-of-time story. When the translator invites Mari to his house for a meal, all the food turns out to be liquefied, pureed fish and spinach in bowls. That's because the translator's nephew is visiting, and he has no tongue. The hotel Mari's mother owns is populated by sunburned guests who pile up dirty linen and dirty dishes filled with bits of ham with teeth marks to be scraped away. Hotels and beaches are transitory places that promise possibility, widened horizons. But in this novel, taking a ferry boat out to sea only transports Mari to another form of servitude. Using spare strokes and macabre detail, Ogawa creates an intense vision of limited lives and the twisted ingenuity of people trapped within them. You'll be glad you read Hotel Iris, and also glad to check out.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hotel Iris by Yoko Ogawa.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama is in the midst of a storm of criticism for his proposals to revamp NASA. He travels to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida tomorrow to defend his vision for the space agency and announce some revisions. While supporters say the president's plan charts a realistic path forward, critics fear he's putting NASA on a mission to nowhere. Even Stephen Colbert has weighed in.
Worst of all, guess what NASA plans to spend its budget on now that Obama has killed the Constellation program? $4.9 billion to develop better robotics and $3 billion to develop unmanned ships. Robots in unmanned ships. Sending robots into space does not win glory for Americans. It wins glory for Roombas.
And NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce covers the space program for us, and she joined us to preview the president's speech. Now, there's some serious business at stake here, obviously, Nell. Remind us of exactly what this controversy is about. The shuttle fleet is about to be retired. Where does that leave America in terms of space flight?
Well, for a while, we won't have any independent access into space. We'll be relying on Russian rockets to take American astronauts up to the International Space Station. Now, NASA had been working on a replacement space capsule and rockets that would take astronauts not just to the station, but eventually to the moon. And, you know, the grand future was off to Mars someday. That was called the Constellation Program. But after President Obama was elected, he asked a blue ribbon panel of experts to sort of assess the Constellation Program. It said that the Constellation Program had long been underfunded, that it was behind schedule, and that its goals weren't feasible. So the White House came up with an entirely new approach. They decided to extend the life of the International Space Station, which is nearing completion, but they would cancel Constellation. And to get astronauts to the station, they would rely on commercial companies to develop kinds of space taxis that would just sort of ferry astronauts there and back. And meanwhile, that would free up NASA to focus on advanced technologies that would take astronauts, you know, someday far out into the solar system, out to asteroids and to points far into space and even onto Mars.
And not everyone liked that idea.
No, it got a lot of criticism from all over, from lawmakers, from high-profile Apollo astronauts. People said, if we're not going to the moon, where are we going? They wanted specific goals and destinations. There were a lot of concerns about jobs. You know, people who'd worked in the shuttle program had planned to move into the Constellation program after the shuttle was retired. But if that program was no longer going to be around, then what were they going to do? People said, if you rely on commercial companies to be kind of space taxi service, what if these companies aren't able to quickly create these capsules and ferry people up into space? The other concern was just a loss of the experience at NASA, which has a long legacy of building and flying spaceships. And there was a concern that if NASA wasn't going to continue doing this, that that experience would sort of wither away.
And what is the president then going to say tomorrow to try to address those concerns?
Well, according to information we're getting from the White House and NASA, he's going to propose continuing part of the Constellation program. So basically, he's going to propose building a scaled down version of the Orion crew capsule. That's where the astronauts sit in. That's the little capsule they sit in. It would have to be launched unmanned by an existing commercial rocket. And the idea is that they just put this up on the space station and have it there as a kind of emergency lifeboat. He'll also announce a plan to speed up NASA's work on the kind of heavy lifting rocket that you need to eventually get astronauts out into the solar system beyond the space station. A lot of people will like the idea of getting into deep space sooner, but the plan that's going to be discussed in the speech doesn't really address the problem of getting to and from the space station and relying on Russia or commercial companies. So we'll have to see. But even people who support the president's vision for NASA say it hasn't been communicated well so far. And this is the president's opportunity to convince people that he really does want to push NASA farther out into space and that he isn't trying to ruin human spaceflight.
Nell Greenfield Boyce covers the space program for NPR. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We all know big sports stars can draw more fans to the game, but commentator Frank DeFord ponders this conundrum. Can a big winner make an entire sport lose out?
As the University of Connecticut's women's basketball team was laying waste to the opposition these past few months, going through its second straight undefeated championship season, the argument arose that the Huskies were too good and thus too bad for the whole sport. It's a perennial debate. Is a sport better off with a lot of good teams battling one another ferociously, or is it best to have one famous juggernaut that attracts attention for its superior majesty? There's no doubt that in individual sports, which can't depend on home team loyalty, the whole enterprise profits by having a dominant winner. Even before Tiger Woods became notorious for being the Don Juan of the demimonde, he was so compelling a golfer that in the tournaments he skipped, there was no sound as the putts fell in the forest. But Woods made fans beyond the cognoscenti look to golf. Same with, say, Michael Phelps in swimming. With team sports, though, it's more complicated. Major League Baseball and the NBA, for example, are completely different in their appeals outside the core fandom. In pro basketball, the Celtics and Lakers may enjoy some historical resonance, but it's stars, not teams, that drive the league's popularity. The dream finale is LeBron James versus Kobe Bryant, and never mind what shirts they might be wearing. Baseball, though, is so much a local attraction. Typical baseball fans are primarily connected to their home team, watching on local TV, listening on local radio, so it's more difficult for national superstars to be created. Thus, for the postseason, a national audience is unacquainted with many teams, so that baseball profits most when well-known perennials like the Yankees dominate. In baseball, familiarity breeds audience. By contrast, the NFL is such a national game and so many people bet the games without an emotional rooting interest that it matters least whether there's a dominant team. Anybody'll do. For men's college basketball, Butler proved that what helps the sport most is for fans to have an outsider to cheer for. But women's basketball is different because it's not top drawer. It needs a cinesure. Basically, UConn proves the point that the less mainstream the sport, the more widespread popularity one lasting dominant team can bring. A team like UConn may be bad for the other women's basketball teams, but it's great for women's basketball.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. It is April 14th, and procrastinators know this. It means you've still got a full day before you need to start doing your taxes.
This year, the federal deficit has fueled debate over how much we should be paying the government, and so has the conservative Tea Party movement. Tea, of course, standing for taxed enough already.
In a moment, we'll hear about the real Tea Party. We'll start with another part of the debate.
Some wealthy people are lobbying Congress with the message, tax me more. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Marnie Thompson is, in a way, still trying to make amends for growing up rich.
I knew we were wealthier than most folks because my folks weren't into flaunting it, but they also sent us to private schools. I went to dancing school. To make my mother happy, I was even a debutante.
But Thompson did not want to carry on moneyed traditions, so she gave what would have been her inheritance, $5 million, to charity. Now Thompson doesn't own a cell phone, but she feels she and her husband still have too much.
You want your taxes to be raised currently?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Thompson will likely get her wish. The Bush administration put in place a series of tax cuts that will sunset at the end of the year. That means income taxes will likely increase for those making more than $250,000, though Congress is expected to extend the cuts for households making less than that. The capital gains taxes will also return to their pre-Bush levels. But it's less clear how much of the dividend taxes Congress will reinstate or how estate taxes will be phased back in. If you ask Jeffrey Hollander, all of those cuts should go away because they primarily benefit the richest, like him.
I do feel that I should pay more taxes, absolutely. While I don't like the way the government spends the money I give them, I do feel that I pay too little.
Hollander is co-founder of the Eco Products Company, Seventh Generation. He grew up in New York in a huge Park Avenue apartment, a world with doormen, maids, cooks, and vacation homes. He's in his 50s now, so he was a teenager during the social unrest of the late 1960s.
I felt terribly, terribly guilty about having so much money as a kid.
Hollander even left home as a teen, lived out of his car, and eventually struck it rich with his own business. He says he doesn't believe in trickle-down economics.
These arguments really are about keeping a lot of money in the pockets of people who already have too much money.
It might seem strange that some rich liberals like Thompson and Hollander would campaign to pay more taxes, but they say it's not as weird as it seems. Though there's plenty of evidence to the contrary, they point to a recent Quinnipiac University poll showing nearly two-thirds of wealthy households support raising their own taxes to reduce the government's deficit. In the past, other super-rich people, including Warren Buffett and Bill Gates Sr., father of the Microsoft founder, have championed the pro-tax stance. They said their wealth should be taxed heavily to support the public institutions they say allowed them to succeed. Politicians, though, are most familiar with the argument against taxes. And Marnie Thompson says it's as though elected officials don't know what to do with her letters.
As a wealthy person, I want you to tax me more. And the letters I get back in no way acknowledge that kind of argument.
Obviously, they're entitled to their opinion, and it's certainly refreshing that they're willing to take an opinion that runs contrary to their, you know, short-term personal interest. But that doesn't mean that their position is necessarily right.
Alan Viard is a scholar for the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. He says taxing the top 2 or 3% of earners won't raise nearly enough to patch up the deficit. Tax increases over a broader swath of the population and spending cuts would be necessary to achieve that. Besides, Viard says, higher taxes for the rich may not be in the overall economic or public best interest.
I don't think it's going to be too big of a surprise if you see some reduction in saving and some reduction in investment.
Jeffrey Hollander, the eco-products millionaire, believes the country faces too many grave social and economic problems not to tap the resources of the rich. That doesn't mean paying taxes is barrels of fun for him.
You know, I can't deny that it is sometimes painful to have to write the check.
But he says he's better equipped to handle the pain than most everyone else. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.